Welcome to Irrination, Australia's own landscape irrigation podcast. It's time to dig into this week's episode with your hosts, Richard Jolly and Adrian Walsh. They'll be discussing everything from irrigation design and installation to sales and technology, so this episode will have something for you. Whether you're an architect or homeowner, a landscaper, or just have a keen interest in gardening, the Irrination podcast is sure to make your day that little bit better.
Hi, and welcome to Irrination, Australia's landscape irrigation podcast. I'm Adrian Walsh.
And I'm Richard Jolly. Good to be back, Adrian.
It is good to be back. It is really good to be back. You finally found a location that you can do some recording on. Richard's had problems with the internet, with echoey noises in the background.
People closing doors.
Okay. So hopefully we're all right. So Rich, you know what? I was just looking at podcast stats and we're up at around 1,200 downloads now. Wow. So the downloads are becoming a bit exponential. We're receiving growth.
That's really good.
Enjoying what they're hearing on Irrination podcast. So we'll keep on trying to put the knowledge we've got around irrigation out there.
Excellent. That's really good. We've got those listeners coming in. Let's get some more, eh?
Yeah. So today I want to talk about irrigation maintenance. And as I guess I'll start with Rich, what comes to mind from a customer's point of view from you when you think about irrigation maintenance, let's say?
They don't do it, Adrian. They get the system put in. They see it's all below ground. They can't see anything in the system. All they see is a control on the wall. And they think it's just going to be an automatic system that'll just keep on going off into eternity. But the problem with this is, like an automobile or any other machinery, irrigation needs maintenance, otherwise it will fall apart.
And from a contractor's point of view, what do you think about maintenance? Like our main services we offer, I'd say most of our revenue comes, Richard, from our contracting services, and then it's our consultancy, and then there's sort of maintenance dwindling down the bottom. Why is that? Like what are your thoughts around maintenance from a business point of view?
Well, from a business point of view, it's good for us, but it's even more beneficial to a client. Like if we put in a system and then we get a maintenance contract for it, that client is going to be very happy.
You're right. I think it was more. No, you know, keep talking. You can't be wrong on that question. I've got my angle, so keep
going. Okay. I'll just give you my 2 cents worth. Look, a lot of people don't do it, but we're finding now we're starting to get into some clients that do come in with a maintenance contract. We do a few councils and things like that, but the benefit of a maintenance contract is, and this is just going to be very quick, so I'm sure we'll elaborate on this, is it keeps your system functioning how it should, and that has many benefits. It has benefits for your plants, has benefits for your lawn, has benefits for the running cost, less water, less power, and peace of mind if you go away and you want the system to run. And if you do go away and you've got a maintenance contract, well, we can come in and look at it while you're away as well.
Yeah. Now, can I give you what I think is like the underlying view? I think that was the PR view, I reckon, Rich.
I'm a PR guy.
Can I give you what I really reckon the view is from contractors when it comes to irrigation maintenance?
Yep.
It's a pain in the ass.
Oh, you wanted the truth. Sorry.
I wanted the truth. And I'll tell you why it's a pain in the ass. It doesn't seem to work very well with a business model for irrigation, because irrigation's seasonal to an extent, particular end maintenance. So what ends up happening is, in this is the reality, I think, of maintenance. You're more likely to get calls for installations in the hotter months leading up to the hotter months. So all irrigation installers get busier in that time on installs. When you're on an install, you want to be focused on the project. You may have hired machinery, you've got extra staff, maybe on labor hire, whatever's going on. You've just simply got more. You're focused on the project at hand. And quite often as irrigation installers, we need to travel to do our work. So quite often we'll be an hour, 2 hours from home doing the installation. And here's, I think, the truth around maintenance. You get a call, you're on a job somewhere, someone needs you to come and unblock a solenoid valve. At best, you're probably going to make $200 off it, or $250. You are probably on a project 2 hours from the location. They're pulling you off a project worth tens of thousands of dollars, and they need it done right now.
Yeah.
So do you agree that's the red?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. It always comes in our peak period when we're flat out anyway.
Yeah. And I know that it's been a bit of a thorn in our side, and I don't think as a business ourselves, we've really looked at how we can tackle irrigation maintenance as a service we can deliver really well. It's always a bit on the back burner. Unless something's a super emergency, we tend to get there, but it still tends to pull us away from something because we're always booked out weeks in advance.
Yeah.
All our resources are used somewhere else and you get this call and people want you there in the next 2 days. It's now, I'm not having a crack at customers. I can't do that, but it's just painful. And then you go, well, how come, why don't you start up a maintenance division? Well, I think there's some issues around that. You know, you have guys on and guys, girls on, and what do they do in winter? And I think we're starting to come up with a model. We are opening a proper maintenance division. That's on the cards, right, Rich?
Yeah. But
that's a real hurdle that we've had to come across. What do we do in winter with those maintenance staff? And we've had some thoughts around that, around some proactive maintenance contracts and things, auditing, irrigation efficiency testing and things like that to fill in that time. But what I wanted to start with today is, as you know, Rich, I've been working on our systems and I've been reading some books around it. I've been doing some study around systems and I'm following one book at the moment, which is Systemology. And we've got onto this thing called System Hub and we're trying to get a way of doing everything in our business. You know, there's a way that things are done at EcoStream. So, Rich, what are some things that you've helped record that come to mind on our System Hub?
Oh, well, every morning we'll do a plant check on any of our machinery.
Yeah.
You just hook into System Hub, gives you the links, you fill out the form.
So there's a system on how to do our machinery checklist.
Yep.
And it's all there. Without ever coming into EcoStream, you could be given that link on how to do it and you'd be able to complete a plant.
Yep. It works really well.
Works really well. So one of the key things in Systemology, because creating systems seems like a super overwhelming task. Mm-hmm. Now, I think if you were selling one product or service to one customer type, you would be fine in creating systems in your business. It would be super, super easy. For example, if you literally just had a website and you're selling a certain type of sprinkler, you knew your market was landscapers and irrigation installers, you market to them, they pay you in a certain way, and the process would be pretty easy. Creating systems in a business like ours seems to be a more monumental task because we've got a bunch of services selling to a bunch of different types of clients. And that felt really difficult because when you go to create a system for, let's say, making a sale, it can't be a general system. It's got to be quite specific. And the way that we make a sale to a commercial client on a project is going to be really different to the way we make a sale to someone who comes in and buys a bunch of sprinklers over the counter. Mm-hmm. The payment terms are going to be different. The way we raise the quote's going to be different. The way we do the proposal is going to be different.
Yep.
And so one thing I've learned on Systemology and reading that book is the best way to create a system workflow, so all of your systems that list your interaction with your client from the time they contact you to the very end, to the time you send the invoice and they pay you, and then a way of capturing that client so you can do repeat business with them. The best way of creating the system according to this, and it seems to be working really well, is you choose one service to one type of client. So what my thought was today is we could maybe nut out a little bit how we're going to create a system for maintenance for a domestic client on a domestic irrigation system.
Okay.
So the service is a maintenance check for a domestic client who makes contact with EcoStream and we need to go out there and do some work. I want to particularly focus around the actual operational stuff in the field because there's a bunch of things that we do beforehand that are sort of internal processes around them making calls and things, and we've got a bit of a process before that. But I think the listeners would get the most benefit around from the time we get to site to the time we leave site with that system's being repaired. So let's say customers called us up, we've qualified them as a client, they've rung me and they said, hey, Adrian, my system's not working that well. There's a couple of valves are not coming up. I just want you to do a run through of the system. And it's a conventional system because it's a domestic customer. So we're not going to go down the Dakota road or anything. I just want to talk to you about where we start and what would be a good workflow there. So where do you reckon we could start when we first rock up to site?
Well, the client will give us some indication of what might be going. They might say system's not working, it's not coming on at all, or, you know, there's two valves that aren't coming on, just needs a general check. The very first thing that I normally do is I'll go to the controller. Okay. I'll go to the controller. I'll look at how many stations are in the system. And then I will, before I do anything else, I will meter each of those stations to make sure that I've got continuity to each of those valves, which means I've got power going out to each of those valves. My wire, my return wire from the controller to the valves is all good. Because if I start that system, if I don't do that and I start working through the system and all of a sudden I say, oh, only six valves are working, the client could turn around to me and say, oh, well, hang on, Richard, everything was working before you came here. And I can now say that if I've tested that system, like I've tested the continuity of each valve, I know for a fact either all 12 or 15 or how many stations are working or only three stations are working. And the first thing to do, I'll let that client know that I've done that test and we've only got, say, five or six valves working out in the field. And, yeah, and then we'll move on from there.
Okay. So I guess we need to look at documenting this as part of a system. So do you reckon the way that we do this is maybe create a form with check boxes or something with a question? The first thing is go to controller and we'll have a bunch of check boxes with valve 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you tick if you're getting a reading between, what are you aiming for a reading between, Rich?
Oh, anywhere between 20 to 50 ohms. Average domestic will probably be around 30, 35, but they'll all work within that range, even a little bit higher.
Okay. And then we just put an X on any of them that aren't in that. I know some can still work in that, that realm, but
you can get quite a high reading, but the system will still work. But at least you've flagged it and you know there could be a potential issue down the track.
Yeah. So where do we go from there? Let's say we kind of need to go one of two roads, like either everything is passed and you move on to something, or you had some failures and you move on to something. In the scenario where everything passes, what do we move to?
Well, the next thing I'd do is I would just start working through each station and just make sure I'll turn each station on, find out where they are. If it's only a small, quarter acre block or whatever, and just make sure everything's popping up. And then I know everything's coming up correctly because you can still have voltage going through to your valve, but you still might have the valve not coming on for some other reason. You might have a ball valve turned off, an isolating valve. So I just want to make sure each station's coming up through the controller.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So start at the controller. Maybe you can run a test cycle.
Yep.
So run test program. You might be able to, if they don't have a test function on the controller, maybe you can create.
Yeah.
In program D, just like a test program.
Station or whatever. Yeah, that's fine.
And then you go through. And maybe we need to look at doing some checkboxes for each of those stations and with a bit of a description. So checkboxes around what's going on with each valve.
Yeah.
And so then you could maybe write in one space, you could write station one. You could do a little description like back lawn. And then there could be a checkbox of passed or fail and then description about why it failed.
Yeah, it could be low pressure. It might be coming on. You might have a break. So,
yeah. At least I guess you know what you're starting to work with. Like if you do that test, you're going to be able to go, okay, well, in this scenario, it passed all the continuity testing.
Yep.
But we turned it on and everything worked, but we know that there's a broken head on valve 6.
Yep.
And you know you're just going to go back to that.
Yep. That's right.
You know, I mean, this scenario that we've just spoken about where everything passes and then maybe two things have got something going on, you're still probably only on a minimum call out, aren't you? Really, yeah. Like a spray's broken or something like that. Okay. So in that scenario, a spray's, make repairs, document repairs, and then you could maybe, what do we do around scheduling and stuff? Because I know that there seems to be some general things that people do rather than looking at proper scheduling. So, for example, it might be a common thing that a landscaper might go, oh, I always do drip at 20 minutes three times a week. And I always do MP rotators at, whatever it is, 30 minutes, 2 days a week. But what do we do around that with that scheduling stuff, Rich? Because to view something on site, how do you make a call about what the scheduling should be if you've never sat down and looked at how they're spaced, if you don't know scheduling, coefficients?
Good question. Well, first thing, you'll get, just as a visual, you'll get a good indication whether the plants are healthy and they're getting enough irrigation, okay? Now, you will certainly know with drip or sprays if they are starting to die, whether they need more water or not. And so when it comes to scheduling, you've got to, There's a little bit of science to it. You've got to know what you're dealing with, what your application rate is, and I won't go into all of that. But, you know, if you've got a sandy soil and you've got drips in there, just say a landscaper's come in or they've done it themselves. They've put, you know, drip lines along a sandy soil. It's a box hedge. Okay, and they're running it for an hour, and for some reason they're finding that it's just not getting water. You know, the box hedges are dying, and they're getting yellow at the edge of the leaves, and there's no growth there. Good chance is they're not getting enough water purely because of the way the system's designed. First of all, the drips are probably just putting water straight through to down below the root zone because it's sandy. It's just percolating straight through. And secondly, the spacings might be wrong as well. So that's just something you would bring up with the customer. Maybe it just needs a bit more of a another row of drips put in and shorter cycles just so you're not having excess water through the soil. You've got to look at one of the things, you've got to look at the soil as well, because I know that we can get some higher loamy clay soils and, you know, you might look at a standard book that says, oh, this has got to be water for half an hour, you know, 3 days a week. You might find you only need to put on that, you know, water on that five minutes every time. So you might, instead of watering for an hour and a half, you might put them 15 minutes because the water holding capability of that soil is so much greater. And if you overwater, you're just going to flood it. It could, you know, that'll be detrimental to the plant as well.
So, all right. So maybe after you've done the checks and you've got things repaired, and we're going down this, we'll come back a little bit in a second to look at fault finding for wiring and stuff. Yep. So down this road of doing the checks, doing a couple little repairs, trying to get an indication. One thing that I tend to do, I find, is particular domestic systems that have odd shaped lawns, and we've spoken about distribution uniformity in a different podcast, so there's probably no point going really down that road. But at the same token, in a small domestic system, head to head spacing seem to be okay. You know, when we're talking small lawns that aren't expansive, all the sprays are on the edge, you probably can't do a whole lot with distribution uniformity. Yep. It's probably best to do something like head to head, or just a bit better than head to head.
Yep.
You know, whereas it's in large turf areas and large installations that we can actually look at starting to measure efficiencies.
Yeah, that's right.
So in that domestic environment, I do really think that there's a lot of onus on the client to keep an eye on the irrigation system, to look at if you've come into a system that's never been monitored, has never had anything really set properly. I think there's going to be a real onus on the client for you to say, listen, I'm going to set it up to what I think it should be based on, and what the best we can do is we can look at the data on, say, the MP rotator, and I'm just going off the top of my head, yep. Rich, because but head to head, because I don't have a Hunter catalog in front of me, but head to head, that should be doing 11 mil an hour.
Yep.
You know, like let's say. And we're in spring, and you got a pretty established garden, so we really want to get it at 20 to 25 mil a week on there. So we want to run it for about 2 hours a week, right? As it's coming into some hotter weather, we want to run it for 2 hours a week. We're going to do it over 3 days, and so you work out the times based on that. But at that point, there, I think you need to say to the client, listen, you're going to have to keep an eye on it because, you know, it might be too much. It actually might be too much. Maybe we could try to drop it down a day, a week of watering, or maybe we could actually get the times down a little bit. But you know what? Like your site, it's got shade on this area and that we need to look beyond just what the catalog says.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's all site specific.
Everything's site specific. All right. So I think you can set something basic based on what you can see on site, the leaderage of the drip light, the spacings, working out the application rate based on the spacings of the drip system, whatever you're dealing with. You can work out some basic stuff based on some basic industry standards for domestic. But I think you need to look at scheduling the controller as a next step and then saying to the client, I've scheduled it like this, and this is why I've scheduled it like this. Don't be one of the guys that goes, I scheduled the MP rotators for 20 minutes a station because that's what everyone does. Like, have some basis around what you
Yeah.
Looking at the data and go, I've done it like this because of this, right? I've done it like this because a catalog says this at head to head or whatever. So I've scheduled it. It's going to come on these days. Can you keep an eye on it? If it's getting a bit wet or if you think we can reduce it back a bit, maybe you could show the customer how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so seasonal adjust is our best friend, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So, okay, so you schedule the controller for the customer, show the customer how to make changes. Now, if you've got some sort of smart controller, you still might want to look at doing some adjustments, but they might be a tad different. You might play with around with the trigger points and hydrolyze or how to make changes. And so there's a couple other things we probably need to have a look at. We probably want to have a look at the rain sensor, test it. So run something, press the top of it, go up there and just see. And you probably want to look at replacing the battery in the controller, backup battery.
Yep.
And, you know, you could probably do those things, Rich, when you're actually doing your initial tests.
Yeah, that's right. It just takes tests and change the battery over.
Test rain sensor. Now, from a business point of view, and not only business point of view, from a best thing for the customer point of view, it's at this point, once you're finished, to maybe look at offering some improvements to the system. So maybe you could have some improvement options that you give a quote for when you hand the invoice over
to
the client. So some improvement options might be something like, hey, you know what, we saw that line, the MP rotators just weren't running the way they should. And we need to look at splitting that zone and adding another zone in.
Mm-hmm.
Or, hey, we've noticed that, listen, you've got 10 stations here. There's a controller out now that's smart. You can go Hydrolyze. You can go a Beehive. You can go the Rainbird Link. But for XXX amount of dollars, I shouldn't say XXX amount of dollars, should I? I should say, probably use the wrong terminology there. For this amount of dollars, we can put it on a smart system, and generally we're seeing 20-30%. Each of the manufacturers will sort of give you a bit of an idea about what the difference is in general, like general savings when you go to each of their controllers.
Yep.
So just from my point of view, when I've installed a Hydrolyze on a site, I've generally seen like a 20-30% saving.
Yep.
Compared to a traditional time-based controller.
They do work very well.
It's really affordable now as well.
Yeah, they're not expensive.
So, you know, you can look at options like smart controller.
Yep.
Or splitting a station. Now, that might actually be relevant, right? Because I know across Melbourne, they've in some areas lowered pressures in areas because, you know, the water authorities want their booster pumps to run more efficiently, whatever the reasons are.
Yep.
I know that they've lowered some pressures around. So that may actually affect the irrigation when it comes to what the original design intent was.
Yep.
What may have happened, Rich, when they originally did the install?
Oh, they might have designed it, say, you had a 400, off the top of my head, 450 kPa static. You might have had sprinklers running at 340 kPa or 300 kPa. You've allowed for your head losses in your mains, your master valve, your solenoid valve. That's all working fine. Board then comes along or your water authority and, you know, might crank that down by 80 kPa. And the reason they do that is it mitigates their losses in their pipelines in the street. If they've got a leak and that leak's running 80 kPa less, they're going to lose a lot less water. Plus also it's less pressure on their system. But the main fact is that when it comes back to the irrigation of your client and he goes to then turn it on with 80 kPa less, if that's a spray system, there's a good chance that's not going to work at all. It's just going to just bubble out. It will not be head-to-head sprays. You'll get donut effect. You'll get pooling. You'll get dry spots everywhere. And so that's when we might suggest the client, well, look, you can't do much about what the pressure is out in the street, but we can change this maybe to a drip system or, as you said, zone it in half if they still want sprays, depending on the type of system it is.
Now, I'm going to go a little bit everywhere on this call because this part of this was just about us nutting this out and trying to work out. Now, I'm looking at what we should be doing by the book when it comes to irrigation maintenance. Now, there's a bunch of things we haven't even mentioned yet.
We haven't
mentioned about clearing out or flushing the drip lines.
Yep.
You know, like generally there's a flush point put on drip systems. But yep. It should be. Here's the problem. Most of the time people don't get as-built. They don't even know where they are.
That's right.
But secondly, I don't like this general maintenance check that you do once a year on a domestic system. Now will start blowing out in price a little bit or a lot.
Yep.
Why not? Like what do What do we do about that? Like, how as contractors do we approach a client and say, when they say, I need you to do a run through of my system? In all honesty, most, if you've never rocked up to a system before and there's a couple of little problems and you fix them, and then, but if you start going through what you're really meant to do, which is flushing the line, maybe doing a test of the flow to make sure there's no leaks,
straightening heads and all that type of thing, filtration, cleaning filters out.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many things to do.
So, Rich, can we look at doing something like, this is just coming off the top of my head now. Can we look at doing a few different levels of service? Because we've spoken about this before in the proactive maintenance world, but when we're looking at just general reactive maintenance, do we really need to be transparent with a client and go, listen, there's a few different packages that you can employ us for here. It's the first package is just get my bloody system working package.
Yeah.
Right. So the second package is the efficiency package, let's say. It's the run through and check everything and provide some options.
Yeah, clean bill of health system, but there is some improvements that can be done, which we're not doing at the moment.
Yeah. So we'll check the schedule in that and things like that. And the third one being the platinum, the one where you go, listen, we're probably going to be there for the day, even on your, it's probably going to cost you $1,000, but it's what is required to keep a system going if you're not going to do it yourself. So we are going to clear out all the filters.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do some flow tests. Even if you don't have a flow meter, we can do it through the meter so we can record them and next year see what the flows are like.
Yep.
We're going to actually do a bit of an as-built for you if you don't have one.
Yep.
I mean, what do you think about that? Where does that land? Is that a viable thing to offer clients?
It is a viable thing because, one, it's not like you just – because you could just do that all in the one hit and do it all anyway, and they might get this bill for $1,000, $1,500 and go, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. And so I think that's why we do break it down, isn't like the three different packages. So,
because you think we need to look at that?
Yeah, I think most domestic clients would say, yep, just get it up and running. Because quite often they'll say, oh, look, I can straighten that head up or I can adjust that. I'll just check the drippers later. As long as we can do the, sort of like the harder yards, which they don't want to do or don't know how to do. And then they might turn around and say, okay, you've done that. You've done a great job. You know, come back and go through the rest of it. Do some flow tests, do some pressure tests, straighten up all the heads. Obviously, we need to raise some sprays here, lower some here. They're sunken, you know.
I think this is really important. This has been one of my main concerns around maintenance is how to approach the expectation of the client.
Yep.
Because as professionals, we're kind of up here, like with our expectation of what we want to deliver. But the clients are going, man, well, my system's been working for like past 10 years and all of a sudden the solenoid wasn't working. And really, I just wanted you to get that up and running.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
But maybe we need to look at talking to the client and saying, look, these are all the things that should happen. And whether we do it or you do it, whatever, someone really should be doing it.
Yeah. But at least give them that option at the start and then they know where they stand then.
Yeah. And that's good.
Yeah. And that way we're not presenting them a massive bill like, whoa, I'm not paying this or, you know. Yeah. They weren't expecting, which is a bit of a shock to them. Which
I'm writing that down. So some levels for reactive maintenance, some levels of expectation.
Yeah. What to expect in the visit.
I would say that most will go for that get it working option.
Yeah. Because I've been to jobs in the past where the system hasn't been working and I let them know. I've spent a day and a half, 2 days just finding wire breaks before doing anything else. And that's just been a master valve working or something like that, you know, because there's been no as-builts or anything like that. There's no plans whatsoever. And you have to be upfront with them. You tell them, I could find this break in 5 minutes. It could be simple. You might have dug a tree or put a fence in somewhere, gone through the wiring. It could be an old thing that was nicked 15 years ago or the wiring and now it's just rotted out. It could be a nightmare to find. So it's all about being open and honest and saying, could be this, and while we're going through this process of doing the maintenance, we let them know, you know, how we are actually going. So, look, I've spent 4 hours on this. I haven't found it. Would you like me to go into this? We can get all this up and running and, yeah, give them some options.
Because on the other end of it, like on one end of overdoing it, this is where maybe we've been wrong in the past and we haven't had huge complaints or anyone or anything, but it's been awkward sometimes. And I think the awkwardness comes from things like, you rock up to a system and on the other alternative, you go, someone goes, come and do a maintenance check, and you think they're coming from the point of view of just getting, you know, they just want you to come and get something checked out and working again. And you do that, you go and you get the, you get a solenoid valve up and running again, or you, there's one that's stuck open because it's leaking or something, and you do that. And you don't do anything else. You just literally do that. It took you 2 hours. You give them the minimum charge. Yep. And then you get a call up from them and they say, hey, there was out the back, there was a leaking flushing valve, you know, and it's hidden behind a shed somewhere. If you went to really look for that, you probably would have been there for an extra 2 or 3 hours and charged them an extra $300-something odd.
Yep.
But you didn't realize that they wanted that level of service.
Yep. So I think it's imperative that when we first, you know, we get the call or we, you know, have the discussion with the client, we let them know what their options are and what they actually want from us.
I'm going to document these options. This is the main thing, documenting them and giving an idea of how long that would take each of those things and what their level of cost is probably going to be on each of those things.
Yeah. But then everyone's happy because, you know, you want them as a repeat customer as well, and you want them, you know, you want to walk away from that house knowing that your client's happy as well and the system's working to what they expected.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Sure. And, I mean, this applies, I think, to smaller – it probably applies to everything, really, when it comes to maintenance, but what we're discussing probably also applies to smaller commercial systems as well.
Yeah.
You know, so, no, that's really good. Okay, let's just backtrack a little bit. So we went down this road, and so much of it's relevant for everything we're going to discuss today, but – in the situation where something fails on that resistance test originally, Rich,
yeah,
generally, what are your findings required and what are the causes of that problem?
More often than not, someone's cut through something, they've done some digging, haven't told you about it, or they've had another contractor come in, Sparky or whatever, plumber, and they've put a line in, just cut through it and haven't told anyone about it. That's one of the major causes why, you know, there could be a wiring break.
Yeah.
Another one is just longevity of the systems. The coils just burn out after a while. That's just, they've got a finite life. They're not going to last forever. Another big one I would say is wire joins in the ground, which you didn't know about. Like a landscaper or a contractor's come in, they've put the system in, they've run out of wire halfway down a main line. They've just done a direct burial splice with the wiring and kept it running to the valve. Haven't put in a valve box, haven't done good wire joins in it, like use proper silicon sealed wire joins. They just direct buried it. A couple of years down the track, the thing's just rotted out. That's the biggest one we find.
Yeah. Okay.
And because you might start from the control, you find you've got a red multi-core loom going out. You go to the valve box, it's blue. You know you're going to have an issue straight away because somewhere that wiring loom has changed.
So when things, I'm just wondering if we need to have some sort of, and once again, it's about transparency, I think. When things are installed properly, like when things make sense, like when the wire runs with the main line, when you use one type of loom, it doesn't change different wire sizes and colors down the line, when you use proper joins, you tend to be able to find the problems more easily. I think that's what you're getting at. And so I'm wondering if we need to have just some sort of document that we create to say, hey, if a system has been installed properly, generally we can find problems pretty quickly. There's situation. I'm thinking back to a situation I had a few years ago that got a little bit, it didn't get heated. I wouldn't say heated, but it got pretty awkward with a client. And what happened was they had a system installed by another irrigation contractor, actually. And this contractor had put two tapping points to two separate irrigation systems. One was for the front yard, one was the backyard. Yep. But they had it looped into one master valve port. So what was happening was the system at the front, even though the sprinkles at the back coming on, the master at the front would come on and pressurize with no water running through it or anything. And what happened was I actually originally got called to replace a coil that had burnt out. And so I replaced that coil and I charged them $300 or something by the time I picked up another coil for that particular brand and found the problem and all that. And then 3 months later, I got a call back and they said, the coil that you installed has failed. And now we want you to come and do that at your cost as like a warranty. Right? Now I was pretty new in business then. And it was a very stressful situation. Now I had told them originally that the reason I think this burnt out in the first place was because you've got a master valve that is coming on with no water running through it. And I kind of left it at that. Now, the reason it burnt out again was for the same reason it burnt out originally. So what do we do to protect ourselves as contractors in these situations where you're kind of repairing something on a system that was never done properly in the first place?
Yeah, it's a hard call, isn't it? I think the main thing is you just got to document everything you find at the initial call out and just make the client aware of it and take photos and just say, look, this has happened because of this. This is what we think's happened. And down the track, this might fail again if you don't rectify it, and give them those options as well. But at least don't have that situation where they come back to you and say, you know, this has got to be done at your cost because it wasn't really even your fault.
Yeah. So
you just got to, and they might not want to hear that you know, because
most of the time they don't.
Yeah, because quite often they've been ripped off by someone, and you know, it's just another thing that annoys them. So yeah, I think it's all about documentation, being open with them. And just letting them know, you know, sometimes they might need to know a bit of technical knowledge, which they don't want to hear, but you might have to tell it to them. And if they don't listen, we just write it down and put it in your report when you put in the invoice. I think it's always good that we write a report, just tell them what, you know, what's been done on that day. And so everyone can refer back to it if anything ever happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Documentation is key.
Yeah. Okay. Keeping people in a good email loop. And
yeah.
Now I'm thinking of bringing in a slightly different, because on our consultancy and our projects, Rich, we use like Google Drive, and that stuff works really well. Like, we've got a few things we use to make things run reasonably seamlessly within the business. Believe me, it's not seamless. We'd be crazy to say it is, but it's pretty good, isn't it? Like, it's pretty good overall,
working pretty well.
And we avoided going down a job management system on our bigger projects because of the amount of the variations that come into it, the scope changes, the way that we need to bill things. Like, we just found those job management systems weren't really equipped for those technical things. Whereas I'm thinking in the service side of the business that actually we could have something like a service mate or something that keeps records, that keeps it simple. So I'm looking at a couple of options. I'm thinking service mate might be.
That type of software, that's where you can also link photos to specific jobs and everything else like that and put in notations.
You can also do things like schedule next year's visit with the client.
Yeah. But all that documentation, that's in the cloud then, so you're never going to lose it as long as you've got
that. That's right. You know, so we could, for example, if we do a mud map or right on site, this is what's going on, you make a note, or we do put some plans, you can chuck it in those files.
Yeah,
at the moment, for our projects, we've got much more comprehensive, you know, storage.
Yeah. But no, that's good.
Okay, so we would often find that a fault, going back to what that fault could be. Hey, there's been situations where I have done those tests on the systems, that original resistance testing, that passed okay, but then the valve still wouldn't come up.
Yep.
And once again, a couple of years ago, I did that. And what I hadn't done was that the controller actually voltage tests, not only ohms test. You'd call it an ohms test or a resistance test.
Yep.
Yeah. If you did that controller, it's probably going to indicate wiring problem or a problem with the solenoid coil.
Yep.
But I've had it in the past where the valve still wouldn't come up. And so the other reason the valve may not come up, apart from there being no water in the system,
yep,
which we've seen happen in the past as well, but is that you're not getting voltage out to the coil.
Very true.
And what I've actually done at the simplest, it's not simple, it's probably the most expensive one, but there was actually a number of years ago where I tested the voltage, an AC test. We must remember, sometimes people get confused and they think that the irrigation control is because they're a lower voltage, like in terms they've got a transformer in them that goes down to 24 volt. The biggest mistake I sort of see with landscapers and stuff is they think that's then DC.
Right.
It's not. You got to do any testing you do on AC on an AC controller. Yes, yep, there is DC controls.
Yes.
It's a little bit different. But on an AC controller, you got to test it on the AC setting on your multimeter,
yep,
voltage setting. But I tested on the ports coming out of the controller. So often what I do, apart from the ohms test, Rich, is I often also do a voltage test now, very first.
Yep.
So I'll actually go...
Make sure you got the proper output.
So I'll do that on the master valve output, and then I'll do it on each station output.
Yep.
And I've found on occasion that the output's not working. And then if I still have a problem, if we're finding everything's working, I'll then probably as my last resort, go out to the field, cut the wires to the coil and do the voltage test on the incoming wires to the valve.
Yep.
To see if I'm getting
still voltage.
You probably want minimum 20 volt there.
Yeah.
You reckon 20 volt minimum?
20 volts will open up a solenoid. That's fine. Depending, there's not a huge pressure going through the system.
This is going to test you because you probably actually want more than 20 volt, to be honest, because isn't allowable voltage drop 10%?
Yeah.
That was the test. Was that the...
But sometimes the coil can run at 22 volts, 20 volts. They're not always...
Well, we've found coming out of the control is even though it says 24 volt, most of the time it's actually probably at 26 to 27.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
You've actually got a little bit more to drop off than...
Yeah, that's a really good thing that you actually check the voltage because, you know, transformers can wear out or they just fail, you know, and you think, you know, everything's working fine. It's all under control. You're running around trying to find breaks in wiring and things like that. So,
yeah.
That'd be another good podcast, all the weird things we've come across in the irrigation field because there's a lot of them.
A transducer. Okay, the weirdest one was a transducer that got affected by static electricity off a pond liner.
Yeah, now who's going to pick that up?
Yeah. All right. We probably won't go too much further down that road of electrical stuff. You know what? Those electrical problems can be the most difficult to solve.
Yeah.
I've found. Just a couple of real other quick things that I think we need to write some processes around because there's a bunch of things we have not even covered yet. But one of them is pumps. And most of the time when you're dealing with domestic pumps, you're not going to be dealing with anything ridiculously complex.
Yeah, high tech. Yep.
On the commercial system, sometimes you can get it complex and sometimes you're actually, I think, better calling in a company, particularly when they're being custom built, they're not from a manufacturer. Sometimes there's a few out there that kind of custom build them in-house and they seem to be a little bit complex or they've got their own PLCs written.
Yeah, but you don't know how to get into their... You know, you first of all, you need a password to get into the touchpad, and then you know you got to work out what you're doing after that. And yeah, there's quite a few different bespoke units out there that will get you flushed a fair bit. So
yeah, so but on the domestic level with pumps, I think there needs to be a bit of process of where we start. Like a common thing that we'll get is a pump cycling. You know, that's the problem. The pump comes on even when the irrigation's not on. You know, and to me, that would indicate that there could be a slight leak out in the field.
Yep.
I reckon it's pretty rare that you're going to find a system that's connected directly to the pumps connected directly to an irrigation control, the relay. I haven't seen many of them around. I mean, they do exist, but they're a bit of a basic system. Do you know what they work? They're not normally very efficient unless this irrigation has been designed really well.
Yep. Most domestic systems, it's going to be 2.2 kilowatt or under, even, you know, 1.5 kilowatt's going to be your standard pump motor size. And most of those run off what's called just a press control.
Yeah.
Pressure control, the pump will start up on low pressure and cut out on low flow.
So what I think you need to be careful of when you're looking at pumps is it's become more common to get like a variable frequency drive unit on a pump or a variable, they might call it a VSD or a VFD.
Yeah.
That's becoming more common. I find there's a bit of a problem that hasn't been discussed properly is that if you've got a very slight leak in the system on a pump with a variable frequency drive unit on it, that the way those pumps, I've seen them work, what happens if you've got a slight leak, it will come on, so it will drop down in pressure, the pump will come on, and then some of these pumps cycle for a long time to try to find out their cutout point. So I've seen pumps go, some models, and I don't think it's a brand thing, I'm just saying, I've seen some pretty big pumps sometimes actually have this tiny little leak on them. So every 5 minutes the pump kicks in, it then builds up its pressure very quickly because it's only the tiniest leak in it. And then the pump tends to like do a hunting for its cutout pressure. So it will run for a long time while it's sort of slowly ramping up, trying to hit its cutout pressure and then ramping back down. Yeah. I know I'm not being too technical on this. I'm trying to be a bit broad, but do you know what I'm talking about, Rich?
Yep.
And that means these pumps can be running 70% of the time they're in some sort of operation. And so I think it's a must having a master valve on a pump system.
Yep.
Because if you don't have that master valve, whether it's a variable frequency drive or a press control unit, if you get the slightest leak in the system somewhere along the line, even a weeping valve or something, that pump can be on and off all the time.
Yep. That's exactly right.
So I think the first thing I would mention to a customer who's got a problem with a pump cycling, unless it's an obvious leak through a valve or something, sometimes you can find an obvious leak, is putting a master valve on the system.
Always a good thing to put a master valve on a pump set. It gives you an extra peace of mind.
I mean, we've had years ago, we've had issues in systems that, and I'm talking about a bigger unit at the moment, but we've had issues in systems that had big, big pump units in them. And they had leaks all through kilometres and kilometres of mainline, like slight little leaks everywhere. You wouldn't be able to find them on an older system. But you got taps running off the line. So they had a shared mainline with taps on it.
Nightmare.
And so we had to look at these things where you'd put jacking pumps in and you put a master valve in with a bypass around it, all sorts of stuff. It can be painful trying to work that stuff, trying to solve those solutions. So, all right, that's good, Rich. I think it's given me a bit of a base to work on. I've got to sort of flesh this out a lot, I think, but I'm excited about starting our maintenance division.
Yeah, no, it should be good. We'll be able to offer a good service.
Yeah. Well, let's wait and see.
We will be able to.
You know what? I really think that having a dedicated team with some systems around it will make that a much less stressful thing to look after.
Oh, without doubt.
Cool, Rich. We're pretty open about what we do, aren't we? Sometimes we put it all out there on the line.
Yeah, no. We want to share our secrets. Well, they're not really secrets, but, you know, if we can help you guys out there and girls, that's what we're here for. Give us a ring. So it won't cost you anything.
Yeah.
Unless you want us to go out and do a service. Yeah, that's good, Adrian.
No worries. All right, Rich. Well, right. I'm going to keep working on that.
I'll go back to my design.
And I'm excited about we're rolling out more and more systems, Rich. System Hub is so good. It is so good.
I'm enjoying it. If I can use it, any of our staff can use it. That's good. It's brilliant. It's a massively good tool to have in the company. It just makes... You just go to this one spot, okay, I need to fill out this form, I need to do a swims for a job, bang, 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 done. You know, I need to do a material, you know, a checklist on a machine. It's got everything in it, you know, a video on how to put a pipe together or glue or, you know, it's got all these options you can use. It can be as big as you want it to be, can't it?
It'll keep going. Our goal is to systemize everything.
Yeah.
To have a way that EcoStream do everything.
Mm.
And the maintenance division, you know, it actually should be an easier part of the business to actually systemize.
Yeah.
Compared to some of the other areas.
Cool.
All right. Thanks, Rich.
Catch you later. See you, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Irrination, Australia's own landscape irrigation podcast. If you want to make contact with Richard or Adrian, please do so through ecostreamwater.com.au and we'll be sure to respond. See you next week.